Heavenly King Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. Please be seated. I'd like to welcome with us this evening Mr. Peter Kyriakou, or Panayotis in Greek, who is a teacher in Canberra, Canberra Girls Grammar, is that right? And a graduate of St. Andrew's Theological College, who did postgraduate studies in Greece, in Thessaloniki, and teaches ancient and medieval history, as well as philosophy and religion at Canberra Girls Grammar. And we're welcoming him to Melbourne. He's staying with us in Melbourne for a period of time, and for much of this year. You've been here already, Peter, which is good to have you here. And we met each other quite a few years back when we were studying at St. Andrews. So you develop sort of a brotherhood with people that you've studied with. Those of you who have studied with people will know what I mean. And it's a wonderful thing to catch up from time to time. And thank you very much, Peter, for coming along this evening and speaking about Orthodox spirituality. What is it and how do we live it?
Today's talk will start off with an analysis of spirituality in secular societies like Australia, South Africa, US, Europe, and so on, just so that we can compare to what Orthodoxy is actually preaching. Now, the reason that Orthodoxy is finding it a little bit difficult in Western societies to preach is because of certain worldviews that are held in those countries. And I'll try and elaborate on that and expand and sort of paint a picture of what this spirit in the Western societies is and where it came from. My talk is basically based on a book that I was given by Father Manuel Lukubandis, which is a beginner's guide to spirituality. So you'll see virtually a skeleton of this book within the power slides. Also, I've added my own personal notes that I use to lecture at Canberra Girls Grammar on worldviews. We do an extensive analysis of different types of worldviews. And combined with the practices of the Orthodox Church, hopefully that's basically a mind map of what the talk is about. So, spirituality. It's a word that's bantered around in today's circles. As I was reading the book, the author starts his book off with a picture of what today's society regards as spirituality. And I thought I'd put the quote in. He was basically reading the newspaper one day and he came across this ad. And it's basically an ad for a dating sort of format, and it goes along: seeking single male under 40, attractive, spiritual, not religious, who likes theatre, conversation and long walks on the beach. And the author starts to elaborate on, well, what does this person who's seeking a certain type of person mean by spiritual but not religious? Now, for us to actually elaborate on that, well, we have to have some sort of definition of what spirituality is. And here is a dictionary definition. Spirituality refers to the practices and beliefs that individuals or groups hold with regard to their relationship to God or the divine. So basically, the definition of spirituality is that it holds certain beliefs. Everything in life works within a belief system. Science works within a certain framework of empirical analysis and deductions from one piece of evidence to another piece of evidence. So there's a whole system of deducting what is true and what is right. But how we operate as human beings also has a way of working through how we navigate through this world. And I like to give an analogy of belief systems in practice is that, for example, in Australia, when you're driving your car along a highway and all that separates you from the ongoing traffic is a white line, and also your belief. You have a certain belief that the car on the other side will not come into your lane and hit your car. So you operate within your life with certain beliefs, and I'll elaborate a little bit later on what that entails when it comes to Orthodox spirituality. So the word spirituality was formerly used specifically in a Christian or religious specific way. You could not in the past, and the author actually goes into, and he says, 30 years ago, when someone talked about spirituality, it was 99% attached to some religious belief, be it Buddhist, Christian, or so on. In today's world, in the world view that we hold today, that is actually slowly being eroded away. Being your spirituality attached to a religion is slowly being regarded as not spiritual. For Orthodox Christians, it's a devotional practice that helps us to put the teachings of Jesus Christ into our day-to-day use as we seek and learn God's will and then do it. So spirituality is our walk with God. You cannot be spiritual without God in an Orthodox framework of spirituality. So good spirituality always tries to balance that relationship. Christianity is always about a relationship, either with God or with your neighbour, with the person next to you. And that balance between God and your neighbour is what I'll be sort of covering in the last part of the talk. So orthodoxy is not about saving us from the world, but saving us in the world. In other words, using the material world as it is created by God himself for our vehicle to salvation or our connection and relationship with God. So let's have a look at what the worldview, the dominant worldview is in Australia today. The dominant worldview, and I like to use art to sort of illustrate that because artists are usually decades ahead of what people believe, sort of the worldviews that are implemented into people's lives. So artists are very sensitive people and they tap into that sensitivity and actually project in their work the future. So they're sort of like little portals into the future. And art, because it's so true to the person painting it, shows a window also into a person's heart. Now, the worldview that's dominant at the moment in Australia is called postmodernism. Postmodernism is something that originated after World War II. To give you a comparison what postmodernism is and what worldviews are, we'll start with the classical period. During the classical period, if you wanted to know what is true knowledge, in other words, what is real, your reality would be determined by three things: tradition, reason, and experience. So, in other words, what your grandparents, grandparents, grandparents regarded as true, that's what tradition indicated. Then on top of that, your own personal reasoning of that truth would also be an indicator if it's true or not. And then finally, your experience of that truth would be the last indicator if that is true. So there were three major inputs to determining what is true or real. Then came the modernist period. After the Reformation, because tradition had been abused and manipulated to, I suppose, create power, dominant powers to control the people in a way, tradition was outright disregarded and thrown out. And a friend of mine uses the analogy of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, the good tradition and the bad tradition was thrown away. And then we were only left with what is reason or reasonable to the person and the person's experience. Here we see the advancement of science and technology. And then we see the development of the Industrial Revolution occurring. And empirical evidence and empirical knowledge became dominant during this period. And this period is probably, the end of this period is around 1945, at the end of World War II. As a result of this dominance on reason and experience and the disregarding of tradition, and remember, tradition also includes the wisdom of the past, Socrates and so on, and a lot of the teachings on how to live a virtuous life. If it wasn't reasonable for whatever reason that the person felt and the experience didn't match up, then it was totally disregarded. And then at the end of World War II, we see a culmination of the modernist period in its worst signs. With modernist thought, we saw the rise of Nazism, totally rational beings that did not take any account of humanity on any level. And as a result, science was used for evil to create weapons of mass destruction. And we saw the culmination of over 40 million people dying. As a result of that, we move into a period where people were so disillusioned with reason and experience that they said, well, reason has caused this, therefore we'll get rid of it and there won't be any pain or suffering anymore. And we move into the period called the postmodern period, where the only thing that matters is experience. A person's personal experience is the absolute highest indicator of what is true and what is real. So, during the classical period, we saw that there was an absolute truth, and that absolute truth was based on tradition, reason, and experience. Then we came to the modernist period, where absolute truth was only based on reason and experience. Well, now we come to the postmodernist period. Well, there is no absolute truth. There's only my truth. There's no past, no future. There's only now. No underlining meaning or purpose, only my meaning and purpose. So what we see is a generation that is basically disregarding reason, disregarding tradition, and saying that my own personal reality is all that counts. So what we see is a generation that basically has no meta-narrative. In other words, they have nothing that they hold absolutely true. And this is where you see a time of period which is sort of, the word tolerism is to be tolerant, sort of is sort of thrown around, to tolerate someone, but it's not really to tolerate. What you see is there is a lack of questioning of what is true. So if someone says, I believe in this, then you as an individual in a Western society would say, well, for you that is true, but for me it isn't. And there would be no questioning of that. And as a society that slowly fragments our society as we see it today. So during the modernist period, we see a rising in the industrial, scientific revolution, enlightenment. But in postmodernism, after World War II, we see this disillusionment in art, which is reflected in, and you'll see some art that reflects that, culture, God, politics, and life in general. Postmodernism came to basically believe that there is no hierarchical structures needed for survival, there's no need for religion, and diversity, inventiveness is all that we need. And the internet and all that has come out of this postmodern worldview. Now, once the material struggle towards the absolute truth, once we have stopped trying to struggle to reach the absolute truth, to reach God, in other words, there is a void inside of us. How do we fill that void? Because materially we've stopped struggling. Our struggle is the material struggle to gain a relationship with God. Well, we have to fill it with something. And this is the rise of consumerism. I shop, therefore I am. And we see that as a consequence of this, our environments, the planet as we know it is endangered from our overconsumption. Western societies produce, I think, nearly 85% of all waste, even though they only represent 20% of the world's population. But consumerism has become like a religion. If you ever go to a mall and you look at the structures of malls, they are quite similar to cathedrals and churches. These elaborate systems of sort of structures where there's a massive lighting and heating. And I recently just came back from Germany, and I went to Cologne to one of the biggest churches in Europe, the Dom. And it was this huge structure that was dedicated to God. And it had an elaborate system of heating and lighting, and all for the glory of God, of course. So material resources were used for the worship of God. But then when we see the malls, the same materials, instead of to glorify God, they are used to market products and sell and to fill that desire to reach with material gain towards the heavens. So our identity then became attached to this material struggle towards the acquisition of products and goods. But then we lost who we are. This is a famous piece of art, postmodern piece of art. And we forgot, well, who are we? Why are we struggling? Why do we work day in and day out to acquire that piece of material good? And then eventually probably we want to update that piece of good, or we want to get a new piece of clothing or so on, whatever the consumerist desires. Why is our struggles moved from the acquisition of the absolute truth to, well, the product? And pop art actually is a great indicator of, and these artists of the 60s and 70s saw what was coming. And they try to send the message and say, well, be careful, you know, this mass production is for what purpose? What's the purpose of it? Why are we doing this? I mean, why are we destroying the environment? Last night I heard on the news that for every piece of, every ton of food that is produced, something like 10 tons of carbon is needed to produce that. For example, fertilizers and so on. Why is this consumption out of control? Well, the postmodern worldview assumes that no interpretation is ultimately reliable. And this is what the problem is, that there are all sorts of inexplicable twists to life, and therefore put them all together, just experience it and be suspicious of any systematic explanations. So, do not trust any human institution. Only trust your own experience. But there's a flaw in that. And at school, where I've got more time, I actually run the students through why that experience is not the best way to live your life. And I'll just give you one example. Experience is done through our senses, our sight, our smell, our taste, our hearing, our touch. Each one of those senses can be tricked. Each one of those senses can be manipulated. Now, in the Orthodox faith, we believe that there are three wills in the world. There is God's will, our will, and the devil's will. And the devil's will is holy and truly only to deceive those five senses. So in a worldview, in a country like Australia, which emphasizes postmodernism as the dominant way to view and live your life, the devil is rampant. He's having a field day because he's going, okay, they don't care about tradition, they don't use their reason, great, I can manipulate the experience. And as a result, we see that our society is fragmenting. Families, it's hard to be a family anymore. It's hard to have a reasonable and sensible relationship with anyone. And these are the consequences of this relativism. What we see here is just some cartoons where it illustrates that on one hand, the guy saying, "You're standing on my neck." And the other guy goes, "Well, that's your point of view. My point of view is that your neck is pushing on my foot." And this is the society that we've come into. Anyone who takes an absolute stance, anyone who says there is a God, is cut down and ridiculed. So, is there any hope? Well, in a society that does not demand evidence or a verdict, in a society that says that no, you, what you believe is only relevant to you, that's quite difficult because that changes your core way of living. And this message that there is no absolute truth is shown within all types of media. We see it in our movies, our TV programs, and even our politicians, when they speak, are too scared to speak from an authoritative position and take a stance on anything. In postmodernism, humour is used, Simpsons, Futurama, and by the way, I'm not ridiculing the TV shows, I'm just saying that this worldview permeates from these shows. Basically, a serious topic is basically shot down using humour and ridiculed. The Simpsons have used imagery of religious figures and have been ridiculed using humour. That's one of the characteristics of postmodernism. Instead of having an absolute stance and saying ministers are bad and religion should be ridiculed, which is a more honest way of portraying what they believe is true, and that's okay if they believe that's true, fight for it. But they use humour, which brings in this undertone, which finds it does not rely on your reasoning power to determine what is happening in that show. And because it's subconsciously implanted, then you yourself implement that worldview in an exterior way. Even if you believe in God, you find hard to talk about God because of this undertone of ridicule which is projected in all forms of media. And just to sum up on postmodernism, and then I'll go on to orthodoxy. In postmodernism, there's a blurring of the real and an emphasis on the virtual. Reality, because it is determined by the individual, they cannot be preached. We cannot preach what is real. So there's a deliberate emphasizing of the artificial in stories. And you can see this in any modern movie. If you look at movies pre-World War II and even a little bit after World War II, okay, there was this clear story which had, virtues, morals and everything indicated throughout the movie, and you could determine what the author of the movie wanted to project, what is true and what is not true. Humour and playfulness is juxtaposed with serious issues. So serious issues are basically undermined. South Park does that to the extreme, where they'll take a serious issue using humour, they'll try to ridicule it. Challenging the rationale, scientific thinking and interpretation. So science cannot even make a statement anymore in this postmodern world. And it's usually shot down by people that basically don't use the same methodology as science. Fragmentation, distorting, there's a mixture. There's applying of time sequencing in movies, so there's no sense of time or reality. And there's an emphasis on pleasure and enjoyment. With the last one, that is quite dominant. I work in a high school. It's a girls' school. And I see a lot of body image problems, especially with this last one, where girls, unfortunately, in media and social, the social structures that we have due to this emphasis on experience, girls are unfortunately are forced into not feeling good about themselves and their bodies. And as a result, we have quite high rates of anorexia, attempted suicide, and so on. Now, unfortunately, because I'm limited by time, I'm doing it in a three parts in Bentley and at Moonee Ponds churches. So I actually go into more detail in those two churches. So on Tuesdays and Mondays, I'll be at Bentley and Moonee Ponds, and I'll be actually deconstructing this even more. So I'm just trying to paint a little image of basically what the spirit of this society is. It's a spirit which frowns on absolute truths, so that gets rid of any idea of God being absolute, and basically says to any institution, well, we don't trust you. And we can see that where church attendance has fallen from the 1950s, where there was 70, 80% of people going to church, to now where there's less than 10%. Now, the Orthodox way. Christian Orthodoxy talks about a physical reality which is full of the spiritual. Orthodoxy is a material religion, not like some religions where it's all about energies and dualities of good and evil. Because God became man, because of the incarnation of our Lord Jesus Christ, Orthodoxy is fully immersed in the material world. The material world for Orthodox Christians is not evil. Plato saw the material world as corrupt, and he talked about the idea being pure and that we should strive for the idea. Well, because of the incarnation, the material became sanctified. And for us, the material is not evil, and it's not to be subdued to God's will. It's to become one with God because it's sanctified in itself. Because nothing can become one with God unless it is sanctified. If the flesh was evil, then we could not become one with God. And because God became man, because of Jesus Christ, now we can have a full relationship with God. There is no barrier between us. But first, these absolutes that we've talked about that are rejected by society, that God is eternal, unlimited, and he's loving, and his love is without limits. So the worst of the worst, if we go into any type of sin, God will still love us. So even if we fall from the highest mountain, God is still there for us. And I wanted to illustrate that by showing a little video. And this video shows the faith of a young child. And I think it illustrates this love and faith that is contrary to the world view that we have.
Well, they call him the Sky Angel Cowboy, the voice of a little boy who called a radio station to share a story and a lesson that God showed him, a message that has now captured the world's attention. This is 13-year-old Logan Henderson. He lives on a ranch in the middle of Nebraska. Isolated from much of the world, he often listens to KSBJ Christian Radio out of Houston, Texas, which he picks up on Sky Angel. In late October, Logan made a call to the station that would soon be heard around the world.
Hey, Mike, can I talk to you?
You bet, Logan. What's up?
I want to tell you something that God just told me.
Okay.
Last night, my dad was roping this calf. And this calf had been born from a really old cow. She didn't have really the greatest milk. She didn't have, like, the vitamin C and stuff.
Okay.
She broke her back. And this morning I went out and put her down myself. I was talking to God. I was asking God why. She was special. And God said, you know, Logan, my son was special, but he died for a purpose. It's kind of the same thing. That calf was close to me, and God's son was close to him.
Logan, you're so right. It's true. Think you're going to be okay?
Yeah, I'll be fine. But I wanted to tell you guys that is so important. Just remember, when you lose a loved one or a pet, always remember that God gave his son too, and he understands. He will always understand. He will always just run to him.
Logan, you're wiser than you know, buddy.
Oh, I just
figured I'd better call and share with you guys. Love you. Love you too. This is in contrast to the spirit that I've just been talking about. There is a God. He is eternal, unlimited, and loving. And this is the focus of Orthodox spirituality. That every human is valuable because they are in God's image. God himself gave everything for us. He spoilt us. So how can this ultimate gift that was given to us, how can we as Orthodox Christians live it? Well, throughout history, the Orthodox Church has only purpose has been to worship the living God and to become one with that spirit. All the rituals that you see in the Orthodox Church are shaped to shape us. In postmodernism, in a lot of Christian churches, unfortunately, because of this emphasis on experience and the rejection of reason and tradition, churches now have been shaped in our image. The Orthodox Church, because of its apostolic traditions and its affirmation of the Old Testament, the traditions that were passed to Moses and all the prophets have still been kept alive. Even though in a society that says and looks at our church, well, that's a medieval church, it's not modern. That for us should be a compliment, because our church doesn't model itself on us. Our church models itself on what God's commandments are. And that's why it's a bit difficult sometimes to understand the processes that are going on in the Orthodox Church, because we're living in a society that has this worldview, but Orthodoxy is preaching this because this is what God wants. So what it all comes down to is that spirituality cannot be separated from religion. Once you separate religion from spirituality, you start believing in yourself, because you're the one who's creating your own spirituality. It has nothing to do with God. In Christian living, fact precedes feeling if we are going to have any kind of healthy, robust relationship with God that results in spiritual growth. Your feelings cannot be the holy basis, of your relationship with God. Because if you put that as the highest interaction with God, then the devil will go full bore on you, because that is one of the easiest things to manipulate. I mean, we're all moved by movies and so on, and these arts are good and have a purpose in our lives. But that is just proof that our feelings can be manipulated. So how do we live a spiritual life? Well, in Orthodoxy, because it's about us doing God's will and not doing our will, there's something that we call asceticism. And basically that is an idea of training for the spiritual life, forming ourselves in God's will, not forming our church in our will. And basically in Corinthians, Paul puts the analogy across of the athlete, of how an athlete trains to reach his goal. If our goal is to become one with God, then there has to be a training period where we train to form ourselves to reach that goal. So the spiritual life is not for the timid or the lazy. The goal is continuously to improve on one's performance, moving, as the Bible says, from glory to glory. So it's not about just sitting there and absorbing. The liturgy itself, the word liturgy means work. You have to work at your relationship with God. And in the same way, you have to work with your relationship with any person. Relationships are not just something that happen. There's something that are worked at and built on. And in Orthodoxy, if you're going to go on this training regime, you need a trainer. We call them spiritual fathers, spiritual mothers, but they are essential if you are to finish the race. So to finish this race, this race that we're here on earth, because remember, the purpose of an Orthodox Christian is to be one with God here right now. You don't have to wait to experience heaven when you die. You can experience it here right now. Our DNA, the way that we're designed, is to live in that mode. When we don't live in that mode, that's what hell is. So all the sicknesses, all the problems and suffering of the universe is because we don't live in that mode of racing towards God. Now, when you're looking for a trainer, a spiritual father or a spiritual mother, St. Gregory of Sinai says, to guide others is not for everyone, but for those who have been given divine discernment, what is called by the apostle the discernment of spirits. So St. Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about this discernment, and he says it's not for everyone. And in the Ecumenical Patriarchates, the bishops in the Ecumenical Patriarchate, the diocese or the patriarchate of the Ecumenical Patriarch, the bishops there do not make everyone a confessor. So if you're a priest, for example, in other dioceses, you are made a confessor. But in our diocese, only the best of the best are chosen as confessors. And the archbishop goes through a rigorous system of choosing who is to confess and who is not to confess. Now, once a confessor or a spiritual father is found, and you are to establish a relationship with that person. Everything to do with Orthodoxy is about relationships. That is why the church is essential for that, because in your home, with your icon, you can't have a relationship. Relationships, without relationships, you cannot be saved. So through relationships, through the church, our spiritual rule is set up. So the purpose of a rule is to be an aid in our training. So what is this rule? So in other words, you set up a regime of training. It's called a rule. Right? So, for example, if you're training to be an athlete, you have to get up at a certain time. You have to do a certain amount of push-ups. You have to do this. You have to eat that. You have to do this and that. There's a regime, a rule that you follow. This rule is also the same for your spiritual life. If you want to live a spiritual life, one full of tradition, full of reason, and full of experience, you have to train. And the rule covers things like what you eat, what you, how you pray, what you pray, church attendance, and so on. For every person, it can vary, especially in today's society. In the old days, people didn't work on Sundays, for example. So that regime has to be modified to suit this worldview in a certain way. It's just a convenience thing. So, and also if you have a medical problem, for example, and so on, it'd be ridiculous to fast, especially if it'll do more harm. Remember, orthodoxy is about the sanctification of the material. If you go out and harm yourself, that is actually going against God's will, and it's actually an insult on the incarnation. So all these things are worked out with your spiritual father or mother, and in obedience and direction, received, developed into a framework within which you follow Christ each day. So the object of prayer, fasting, church services is to make Christ real inside of you. So at this point, some people might be saying, well, I knew it, you're about repression. You're about religious rules so you can oppress the freedom of everyone. Well, that's absolute nonsense, because if you look at how people live their lives today, they actually live their lives confessing their worldviews. Every day they put in a rule on how to promote that worldview, be it a postmodern view, a modernist view, or some religious belief. So doing the same is actually the only way that any human being can live. A person who does not live within a certain structure of obedience and have some sort of rule actually ends up probably insane, because that's how we're designed to live, in that mode. So, for example, if we are in school, we must study regularly. If we work, we need to show up on time. So these are part of a rule just to live your life in society. Well, the same applies to the kingdom to come. If you want to experience God here and now, if you want to live by God's will, you have to have that rule in place. So, what is the mode of existence? With what spirit do we do all this? And I'll just finish up on this and then I'll open it up for questions. As I said, this is a condensed version. I actually elaborate in Bentley and at Mooney Ponds. I actually go into more detail for each one of these sections. So, this is the spirit that we should live our lives, okay? You should all live your lives if you acknowledge that there is a God and He is absolute and that He died on the cross for us, then we should live in this sort of mode, that we should, with all our heart and all our soul and all our mind and all our strength, okay, we should worship Him and become one with Him and meditate on Him. And then secondly, we should reflect that relationship with God with our neighbor. And Father Porphyrios puts it like this, and this is the mode that we should be living in, love. And Father Porphyrios, and I'll finish up on this and then I'll open it for questions. We should look upon all the faithful as one person and consider that Christ is in each one of them. We should have such love for them that we are ready to sacrifice our lives for them. For we ought neither to say nor to think of any person as being bad, but rather we must look upon everyone as good. If you see a brother or sister afflicted with passion, do not hate them. Hate the passion which afflicts them. And if you see them being terrorized by the habits and desires of previous sins, have compassion on them. Maybe you too will be afflicted by temptation, since you are also made from matter that easily turns from good to evil. Love toward your brother and sister prepares you to love God even more. The secret, therefore, of love towards God is love towards your brother and sister. For if you do not love them who you see, how is it possible to love God who you do not see? So that's the spirit and the mode of orthodoxy. So I'll just open it for questions.
Thanks for your talk. So how would you give, if somebody gave you that answer, like, I'm spiritual, or I'm not religious, how would you answer them? What, you know, I'm saying, would you say to them, what does that mean? Or what kind of an answer would you give them if they said to you, you know, what does it mean to be spiritual and religious? Or,
right. My students, because I've got them from year 7 to year 12, by the end of the course, they would never ask a question. They would never say that they're spiritual. They would actually define what they mean by that. They would say, oh, I'm an Anglican, I'm a Catholic, I'm an Orthodox. And then from there, they know that there are set structures of what is spiritual for those groups. Even Lutherans and Protestant groups have structures of what they regard as spiritual. What I would say, I probably wouldn't say anything. I would try not to put someone down because I myself grew up in an environment which didn't really talk about God. So it's not really anyone's fault. But, I mean, if someone pushed me, I'd probably say, well, what do you mean by spirituality? And then maybe have a discussion on that. But I wouldn't put anyone down if they did sort of say, oh, I'm spiritual. Or, but I just wanted to use these analogies just to show you that, you know, this is how people are thinking, but it's coming from a certain worldview where tradition and reason doesn't play a part. All that plays a part is what you can experience. And you can hear the songs as well. If you hear the songs pre-50s, it was mainly about singing about a bird in a tree or something like that. It was about something real. And now it's all about feelings and, you know, love in a carnal sort of matter, sort of what you can experience.
Panayoti, like you, I grew up in an environment where we didn't talk about God either. That little boy there, he's obviously grown up in an environment where they've spoken about God. He has a relationship with God. His heartache, his despair, he took straight to God. How can our church introduce that type of faith to the young kids?
It's the reason I used that child's faith, because it was pure. And that child grew up, and you're correct, in a worldview which basically was immersed that God is absolute and God plays is the highest value that family has. And you could tell by the child interpreting a very difficult situation through the eyes of his faith. And because he interpreted it through his faith, he was actually consoled and realized that that's not the end. So when it comes to orthodoxy, orthodoxy's always had that. It hasn't been a mechanical thing. It's always been a natural process, because you're born into a family which has certain values and a certain worldview, and you're brought up in that. The difficulty comes in Western society, where families have come from other countries to here. They've brought their faith, but because of the environment, the faith has not been able to basically preach its purest form in a sense, because it's still preaching in the sense that it's the thought patterns of the church are that it's still in an environment, a worldview that promotes orthodoxy. But what we see is that the church in Australia has actually adapted quite quickly to that. Something that the West has taken probably 500 years to get to, we've done it in less than 50 years. And I think that shows the flexibility of orthodoxy. Anyone who brings up their children in the church, if they bring their kids to the liturgy, that is one aspect that promotes that. If they also practice the liturgy at home, prayers before they eat and so on, making God the highest value in everything they do, that same faith is transmitted to the child.
You honestly think that our Orthodox Church is transmitting the Christian faith to our children?
Yeah, I think it's doing it in a more effective way than the Western churches, because what I'm seeing is the Western churches, once the child has grown up, because of the lack of liturgy, the child then starts to focus more on reason. So the lack of tradition, actually, the child actually finds it a bit more harder to adjust. And then a lot of them actually go into more experience-based faith, and then eventually that leads to atheism. The greatest portion of atheists have come from these churches that have experience as the main focus.
I thought the word liturgy means a work for the people.
Yep.
So our kids, I missed out because the church didn't communicate the message to me growing up in the church because of the language barrier. My kids have missed out. I couldn't take them. My husband's Aussie. They've missed out. So two generations have missed out. So the word liturgy, to me, my understanding is, a work for the people.
That's correct.
You said how faith is hard work.
Yes.
It is hard work.
It's not for the lazy.
Yeah, but the church is meant to teach us. It's meant to educate us.
Yeah, it does. It does.
I disagree.
The problem is that we don't listen. Let me just elaborate on that. What we do is if we just bring our children just for tradition, if we just bring our children to the church just for tradition, because that's what my grandfather did and so on, then obviously that would be, as I had the slide before, about dead ritual without spirit. So what we have to do is also, we have to immerse our children in the experience of the liturgy and the reasoning behind it. And I'll give you an example. My friend, he's a strong believer, and from a small child he took his children to church, but he didn't just let them be passive in the worship service. He would actually explain the worship service. He would tell them who they are worshiping, why we are doing this, the whole structure of the worship service, how it's immersed in the Old and New Testament, how it's immersed in the Spirit of God, how the Spirit of God is transmitted. So these are things that, as parents, we should teach our children. And once we teach them that, the Orthodox Church actually has the structure that actually can protect them in a society that it's actually against religion. And it takes work as a parent. Unfortunately, our parents probably didn't have the know-how or didn't understand as much. They only had the sort of traditional aspect of it. But they came from an environment which was Orthodox, so it was okay for them because they had other things to supplement that. When they came here, they were faced with the dilemma, well, we've got nothing. And they struggled just to build these churches. A lot of families went, you know, mortgage their houses to build these churches. So just the infrastructure took a lot of energy. So for them to explain everything else, I mean, they probably didn't have the means. But now we do. A lot of the churches have bilingual priests. A lot of them are theologically trained. So we're slowly getting there. You've got to remember the West has been at it for 500 years. So we're just new to this environment, but we're adapting quite quick. We've got a theological college. Australia didn't. It took the first 50 years for them to develop with all the resources of the British Empire, to develop a proper theological college here in Australia, and we did it in less than 50 years. So I think we're doing pretty well, and we've got limited resources. In regards to the language. Look, I come from Canberra, so I understand there's a different problem here in regards to the language. But I want to share this story with you. There's a fellow who converted to Orthodoxy in Canberra in 1961. His name is Victor. He was an Anglican, but he saw what was happening in the Anglican Church and he saw where it was going, and he came to the Orthodox Church and he converted. Now, Canberra is a very Greek parish. English has only been introduced in the last probably 10 years. Before that, English was scorned at. It was not something that was promoted. And we understand that the people that built the churches, that's the environment and culture that they grew up in. But this man, even though he couldn't understand the language, still delved into the Orthodox Church, and then he got baptized. And for 40 years, he was coming to a church that didn't speak his first tongue. But what happened was that the priest saw this person slowly change, and he was moved by this person. And the person, eventually, he was allowed to come into the altar and serve as an acolyte or an altar boy. And he became the cornerstone of the Canberra parish. And I remember as a little boy, we'd hear the Batirimon in Greek and he'd be saying it in English. And he'd be saying the Bistevo in English. And slowly but steadily, the priest's heart, even though he was born in an environment, we've got to understand the Greeks that came here came from a very nationalist country. Greece had suffered many wars to keep its identity alive. So that environment of suffering and struggle, they brought it here, and they were quite nationalist. Now, nationalism is not an Orthodox way of living. I mean, it's not a mode that Orthodoxy is comfortable with. But that's what our parents had. Under the Turks, they were slaughtered. Then we had the Bulgarians, the Germans. We had multiple groups went through. In fact, Greece is the most invaded country in all of Europe. And nationalism was something that came out of that suffering. And they brought it here with us. And, okay, that's probably why they were a bit recalcitrant when it comes to English. But this person, I want to just say that through his love for God and his dedication to the Orthodox faith, he slowly softened the hearts of the whole of the Canberra parish. And he was accepted. He was welcomed into all houses. And slowly English was introduced because of him and his dedication. 2 years ago, another 3 converts came. And because of that, even more English has been introduced. And as a dynamic, Orthodoxy responds to the hearts of people. And I would just say from my experience, keep your desire for the language, definitely, but also focus on what Orthodoxy has to say as well. In the transformation of one's heart, will bring a natural process in regards to English.
I think the best way for you to answer your question would be to get as much English reading books, and then you can explain to the children. Because I, for one, when I was a kid, I couldn't understand it, and I speak fluent Greek. Now, I have since my husband died, went to church due to the fact that I was going constantly because of his memorial service, and I have now books. I follow the liturgy through the English because I can pick up a bit of the Greek when I look through Greek, because it's written in Greek on one page and English on the other. There is a liturgy book that you can get. And then even if you take your children with you, as you're reading and going through it, they can read it in English. Even so much when it explains everything, what they're doing, the prayers, a lot of things, and it's been very helpful for me. And then from that, I've also bought other books that I constantly read. And, you know, I'm 60 years old and I have never been to church as much as I have in this short time, in the last 6 months, and I have gained a lot. I think the other thing also is when you do have mixed marriages, as we do, my grandchildren all, they don't speak Greek at all. However, if there was a Sunday school in the Orthodoxy faith, not necessarily that says, no, you can't come and you can't come because you're Catholic, I think if we as people want our children to follow it, I think there is a responsibility from us adults to be able to provide that English-speaking language for the children.
Yeah, I mean, it does come back to us because we are the church. So, I mean, most Sunday schools are done in English. In Canberra, I can't speak for Melbourne, it is open to all. And we have an Orthodox school here as well. That's everything's done in English as well. They've got a religious program. Two Greek schools, sorry, which have religious programs. We also have youth fellowships. As I said, Mooney Ponds at 7:30, Bentley at 8 o'clock on Mondays, and Mooney Ponds on Tuesdays. And I think here tomorrow we've got an English liturgy. At what time, Father? 7:30. So the access to the services and but the most important thing is us and our spiritual life. And as I said, as you can see in the talk, I focus on our own personal growth in God, seeking a spiritual father, having a spiritual rule, having a fasting rule, trying to live a spiritual life. And included in that rule is also charity, helping others. Dedicating your time maybe to Sunday school and helping teach Sunday school, because we're always looking for more help when it comes to Sunday schools. Maybe if you're quite a talented teacher, maybe helping out at the Greek Orthodox schools and maybe putting some time in helping with curriculum development. We all have our talents and we can all contribute to the church. And that's why we have the church, so we don't have to do it alone. So the focus would be to actually be proactive in your own churches.
Panagiotis, you mentioned earlier that in defining truth, we no longer, or in the modern period, we no longer consider tradition because it has been abused. I'm interested, how has it been abused in the past?
How has it been?
Abused?
Tradition, yeah. Basically, secular powers have used tradition to subdue people into doing bad things, go to wars and so on, and great suffering. People were taxed considerably because of tradition, because certain views from the development of theocracies and, in a nutshell, even the Roman Catholic Church to some extent abused certain traditions like indulgences. Indulgences basically was if you're about to die, or if you've died, your family or you could put in some money and it could help you from going from purgatory to a higher place in purgatory, so you could not suffer as much, because they had this concept of a place where the undead would go and you would have a foretaste of heaven or hell. And unfortunately, it was abused. The Pope himself was not all the popes were for indulgences, but local bishops did abuse that indulgences, and that's just one aspect of tradition, where there's no biblical reference to paying to get out of purgatory, for example. It was a tradition that was created by men, so it was a small t instead of a capital T tradition. And the Protestants, they threw all that out, but they also threw out the good traditions as well, which promoted a relationship with God, a close relationship with God. And as a result of that, because faith is the dominant in anyone's life, a belief system is dominant in everyone's life, that also started to reflect in social structure. And as a result, social structure started to base it mainly on reason. Is it a reasonable thing? And I'll give you one example. The Calvinists in Northern Europe, Zwingli's group in particular, they saw, well, the Bible said talked about modesty and how women should be modest. So they determined, well, what's modest? Well, what's reasonably? Because traditionally, we had a tradition of what is modest. So what they did is they actually instituted a law where women had to have their dress, I think, a couple of inches off the ground. And they had actually spiritual police. So the same thing that we ridicule the Muslims for doing with Sharia law, the Christians were actually doing it way before. They were going like, they had the spiritual police and they would have measuring sticks. And if a woman's skirt was too high up, she would actually be incarcerated and her husband would have to come and take her. And women also were regulated because of the scriptures, because of reason, in certain ways where they were persecuted. And as a result, Later on, as a reaction to that, we saw the rise of feminism. In Byzantium, I was actually talking with one of my colleagues, Nick Trakakis, and in Byzantium, women were quite liberated. They could own land, they could participate in local state-run organizations and so on. All that was gone with the Protestants because they didn't see it as reasonable. And the Roman Catholics, who basically the Protestants came from, also started to instigate things after Trent in regards to women's rights and regulations. So I'm just saying that when reason becomes dominant, tradition, which is the experience of the past, so it's the wisdom. The ancient Greeks actually loved that stuff when it came to tradition. Socrates would always quote it. And it was always about... it was always about the wisdom of the past. So any authoritative statement that was made by any philosopher had to be based on the philosophy of the past, the traditions of the past, or else there would be no credibility in what they would say. And all that was done away. So the experience of humanity was thrown in the bin, and then they had to start all over again. Well, what is reasonable? What is reasonable? And then eventually we created weapons and just Nazism and so on, and using reason. So if you look at reason, for example, the eugenics program that the Nazis had, it was reasonable. Like, if you're disabled, you can't function in society, you have no value, so it's reasonable to get rid of you and to start developing genetically modified people that were perfect so that we can abolish any... See, when reason goes unchecked, this is what happens, where you had disabled people being euthanized in German hospitals. We had homosexuals, Jews being slaughtered, gypsies were nearly wiped out. I mean, this is what reason brings about. So tradition is vital, because that's the experience of all our ancestors in the past. And in Orthodoxy, when we talk about holy tradition, it's immersed in the Bible and it's immersed in the experience of humanity in general.
I was going to bring it back to that, because I have younger people asking me, well, how do you believe that the Bible is in the sense that how do you know that somebody didn't just sit down and write it and now it's being put forward? And when I've asked monastics that, they say, well, we have holy tradition to support that.
Yeah.
I mean, we have... to get it across.
Yeah, we have archaeological evidence. Holy tradition in the sense of the experience of the Christians throughout time. I could do a whole talk on that, but basically there's the Bible was just not put together by one individual. That's another signpost that it's actually authentic. For example, the Septuagint, the Old Testament. The reason it's called the Septuagint is because the story goes that 70 scholars got together in separate rooms and translated the Bible from Hebrew to Greek, and each copy was perfect. So, I mean, there's story after story in regards to the development of this book and the historical evidence that we still exist. For example, all the history that we know about Babylon, Assyria, all these empires is because of the Old Testament's preservation of those histories. And as a result, the Bible was actually in the 19th and 20th century was used as the primary archaeological book in regards to finding things. So if you look at the first Indiana Jones story, that's actually what archaeologists would do. They just get the Bible and go, okay, let's try and find Assyria. It's mentioned in the Bible. And they go, it's roughly here and there, and they'd go there, dig up, and they'd find it. Babylon. With the New Testament, we actually have manuscripts that date from only a few years after the death of the apostles. So in other words, we have primary first-hand evidence. So if anyone watches CSI, right, the same methods that they use in CSI were developed first in the exploration of manuscripts in regards to the New Testament. How do we know if the New Testament is authentic? So what we do is, well, we've got to look at the sources. Is it a reliable source? For example, the oldest manuscript that we have for Plato is, if I remember correctly, 6 AD. All right, 600 years after the birth of Christ. But yet, every historian would say that's an authentic text. With the Bible, we've got literally a couple of years after the death of John that we've got manuscripts. So these are actually closer to the actual source documents that were written by the original witnesses. Now, I just haven't got the scope to go into more detail, but basically, if you look at CSI, the methods that are used there are also used in the New Testament, and we can authenticate most of those books being from the original sources. So in other words, we're talking about eyewitness accounts. So when it comes to the New Testament, with the Old Testament, we have archaeological evidence as well. We dig up these empires and so on. Yeah, there's the oral tradition, and I just haven't got the scope to... But there's ways of authenticating if something is true. For example, my students go, oh, it could be like Chinese whispers. You know, you start something and at the end, because it's orally, it's not written down, because the Old Testament was not written down. It was orally transmitted. So I go to my kids, okay, well, let's try out your theory. Okay, you're saying that eventually, if it starts from here, it'll change by the end. And I go to the kids, okay, I'll take one of the kids, I'll take them outside, and I say to the kid, I want you to pass this message. And I just say, John went down to the shops, jumped over the... And I just give them a complex sort of thing. And then the kids do the Chinese whispers. And eventually, when it gets to the end, it's completely different. And the kids go scream out, yeah, see? See, the Bible's could have been changed. It could have been made up. I go, okay, let's try that again. I take the child out and I go, if this message gets to the end exactly in this format, everyone will get a lolly. Guess what? By the end, it's a perfect... The Bible meant so much to the Jewish people, they would not even change a single tone. That's how important the Bible is. And you can see it today. We have manuscripts where they had two or three errors and the Jews would just dig a hole and dump them. They just wouldn't accept them. That's how rigorous the scribes were, and you can imagine how rigorous oral tradition. And we know that there is a person who is alive today who can recite the whole of the Veda, which is a Hindu text. We're talking about an encyclopedia of text, bigger than the Bible, from word for word without making a mistake. That's in the Guinness Book of Records. So imagine the Bible, which is really significant to the person, that could be... only certain people were allowed to actually memorize it, that being passed on would be basically easy. So we can do another talk on the Bible if you want. I like talking about the Bible.
And I just want to bring out another point that you said, that the whole of the Western world and society is now thinking of self-centeredness. My enjoyment, my satisfaction. So... our whole being is what pleases me, dodicomus inferon, whatever's my for my benefit.
Yes.
So that is a real barrier in the commandment of loving God and loving our neighbour. So it's really hard, even we who are born, brought up Orthodox, or even people who are converts, to get out of our selfishness and to follow that asceticism, which means you do love to another one, you do God's will, you cut your will.
Exactly.
So living the Orthodox faith is so hard if you don't catch on to that major thing.
That's true.
See, so the whole of the world, and even we, can be so selfish, so self-centered that we're just so... So how would you... Okay, we're all here sort of in agreement because we're all struggling for our spiritual faith. But what I find, I was in Greece for a number of years and I've been back here now. Australia's changed. With Australian changing, even we have accepted and soaked up those sick passions of selfishness.
Yes.
How can we, as an Orthodox church, stand up for ourselves, confess our faith, you know, make ourselves known or maybe make ourselves do things correctly, but to the outside world as well? I mean, I'm doing the first thing by walking around dressed like this.
Yes, yes.
That's not easy.
That's a big thing. That's a big thing.
And it often opens up conversations. Who are you? Why are you dressed like that?
Yes. The Bishop of New Zealand went to Fiji and he was wearing his garments And whoever went to Father Manuel's talk on the bishop, and basically because he was wearing the garments, the Fijians would come up and say, "What are you about?" And he'd go, "I'm about this guy." And he actually converted quite a few people with just that simple witness that he would do with just wearing his garments and walking through the supermarket. And not that they didn't have supermarkets, sorry, and things like that. And that's the simplicity of faith that we should focus on.
So we, in our workplaces, in our study, we really need to be just Christian on Sundays.
No.
It really needs to be our whole
thing. No, it has to be all the time. The Archbishop was once approached by one of the high executives of one of the banks. He was a Greek guy. And he goes, "Look, you've got to have a PR wing of the Archdiocese, a marketing wing of the Archdiocese." And the Archbishop looked at him and he goes, "Look, our job is not to market the Orthodox faith. Our job is to live the Orthodox faith." And he goes, "Through our lives, that will have more of an impact than all the TV programs and there's a lot of advertising that Christian groups do. I'm not going to put it down, but I'm just saying one person living the faith in its truity can change thousands of lives. I lived in Thessaloniki, which is in northern Greece, for 6 years. And there's a place called Surudi where the grave of a very holy person called Pater Paisios is. And every year, I'd be blown away, tens of thousands, I'm not saying thousands, tens of thousands of Greeks, Bulgarians and whatever race you can think of, would turn up on the day that he passed away to commemorate his death. I'm thinking one man affected so many different cultures, so many different people. And that's only the people that can turn up on the day. Every second person I'd meet would say a story of how they encountered a person who encountered him, or so on and so on and so on. And all he did, and this is all his life was about, was just basically meditating on God, doing the Jesus prayer, making God real in his life. And that's the impact that he had. Now, I'm not saying that's for everyone. We all have our talents that we can contribute. As I said before, some of us are teachers. We can go and teach. Some of us have gifts in helping people who are dying in palliative care units. I've seen some amazing people here in Melbourne that just by their smile will transfigure someone's depression when they're faced with death. This old lady, I've forgotten her name, just I saw her just basically caress someone who couldn't speak, and you see the demeanor of the person. And this is what we're called to do, and this is the witness, and this is the mode of witness. And we all have our place in that mode of witness. I'm not saying we're all Pater Paisios, but just in our own little thing. I was on an RSL committee that we were building a Hellenic monument to the Cretan resistance. And this RSL digger goes, "Oh, you're Greek, aren't you?" And I go, yeah. And he goes, "You know, I'm from Melbourne," he goes. And he goes, "You know, you Greeks are good people." I go, "What do you mean? Where did that come from?" And he goes, "Well, you see, my wife died a few years ago. And there's this Greek woman who lives next door to me. And she knew that she passed away, and for months after she would come and see if I needed some food, and she'd bring some food and she'd wash my clothes." And he goes, I just don't know why she did that. You know, I never talked to her. She used to talk to my wife, but you know, I had no relation to her. But he goes, "She felt my pain." And this is what Orthodoxy, and this is how Orthodoxy works. It's not self-promoting, it's quiet. But it's powerful. Listen to the liturgy. Live the liturgy. I dare you.
When did you start discovering Orthodoxy, and how did that happen in your case?
Oh, that's a long story. Look, I grew up in Orthodoxy. I remember a 5-year-old kid. I used to run outside and play with the kids. Back then, the churches were full, and people really had a need for God. But as material wealth was acquired, Greeks started to sort of wane away from their church attendance. Doesn't mean that they didn't love God, it just means that they were distracted. But I remember as a little kid standing next to my father, and my father chanting with the chanters. He was in the congregation. In Canberra, it was encouraged for the people to participate in the chanting. And my father was chanting, and I don't know, I felt something. And I wasn't a very good kid. I was a bit naughty. But at that time, I remember that I just stood still when he was, I don't even remember what he was chanting, but I could feel that he believed, and he felt every single word that he was chanting. So I suppose that's my first conscious entry into the Orthodox faith. And then, to cut a long story short, basically at the age of 14, I was with a few mates at someone's house, and we're discussing God. And we came to the conclusion that God is not a personal God. This Jesus person, nah, he's not God. He's a good person, but he's not God. So I came to a deist worldview. In other words, that there is a God who started everything, but he's withdrawn from his creation and is letting his creation take its course. Okay, so at 14, that's the worldview that I created with my friends and we were discussing. And then at the age of 19, I encountered some Protestant people who started to question this deist worldview. And I sort of didn't really like them. They were really forceful. But I was a little bit egotistic, so I wanted to fight them back. So I started to use reason, because that's what I grew up in, an environment, you know, where reason still was a little bit, because the school I went to was a very old school. It was a traditional school. So reason was one of the ways that I was taught to analyze things. And I would use reason against them. And then that started me on a search. And so basically from that, from 14, 19, by the age, end of 19, I had found a very spiritual person in Canberra. We were very fortunate. His name was Father Leonidas of blessed memory. And he basically, he brought me closer to the church. I would torture that man. I would torture him with so many questions and so many, I'd ridicule him. I made him feel this small, but he still persisted, you know. He didn't give up. And through his love, he showed me the true way, because I don't know what I would have become. I would have become a monster the way I was operating in my life. So he brought me closer to the church. He sent me to the theological college. He said, go to the theological college. Theological college just opened my eyes to a completely different world, a deeper breathing of our theology. And then I went to Greece and I just was immersed. And then I came back to Australia. So that's my walk. That's my, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.